My name is Mark in the air. Let me start by praising the audience turnout here. You people have class and taste for coming. You're not like those people waiting in line at Hall H to find out what's on ABC next week. You care about the underpinnings of our lives. It is frightening that we have a panel called 50 Years of Comic Fandom. It's frightening that comic fandom has as much history. It's frightening that comic fandom, which I always interpreted to be done by teenagers in their basements, is done by people with gray hair or no hair, or people who have been doing this so long. Let me introduce to you.
We're still teenagers at heart.
Yes. Some of us are still hoping to get through puberty by the end of the convention. Yes. Let me introduce the dais to you. If you know about the history of fandom, you know that each of these people made a vital contribution, and we will go through what those are. This is Miss Maggie Thompson, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dick and Pat Lupoff. Mr. Richard Kyle. Bill Shelley. Roy Thomas. And Gene Bales. Before I start asking some salient questions, I would like to introduce you to one of the people who's responsible for this convention, the gentleman in charge of all its print and publications. This is Mr. Gary Sassman.
Comic-Con is incredibly proud and pleased to be able to gather these founders of Comics Fandom to celebrate this anniversary. And over the years, we've given out week-pots to some of our many special guests and a few people that have kind of slipped away from us. I don't think the Lupoffs have been with us for many, many years, so we want to rectify the fact that we've never given a week-pot award before. So for achievement in fandom services, I'd like to present the week-pot to Dick and Pat.
You got a better one than I did.
Yeah, they did remodel over the last year. One of the persons I'd like to acknowledge today is a very important part of putting this thing together this year, and also the man who literally wrote the book about comics fandom, the Golden Age of Comics fandom, Mr. Bill Shelley. Yeah.
Awards were started out almost as a joke, and it became one of a very important part of this convention. I want to tell a real fast story here because if I had to pick one incident in the entirety of these conventions that tells me what comic fandom was about, it was this. A few years, this is maybe 10, 15 years ago, I was talking on the phone with a friend of mine named Dave Siegel, who's sitting out there now, Dave, and I said to him, or he said to me, we were talking about comic book artists who had disappeared and had never been to a convention, had never been honored, didn't know they had any fans. And one of us mentioned a man named Fred Gardiner. Uh-huh. Now, people in this room, a lot of people know Fred Gardiner. He did Zatara the Magician. He was one of the founders. This is a guy who's had work in Action Comics number one. It doesn't get any more Golden Age than that. Right. Dave is brilliant at tracking people down. He's a finder of lost artists. He found Fred, where was he? He was in a nursing home in Northern California?
Well, actually, not really found a nursing home, I think. Actually, I found that home.
Oh, okay.
Okay, but may I say the rest of the story? May 19, 1992, I made a trip out to the East Coast. I'm originally from Los Angeles. That's why I never met some of the early people like yourselves. I was inspired by Maggie when you had a wonderful article in the Comic Buyer's Guide, which brought together Bob Kane, Jerry Siegel, and Jack Kirby together. We've seen a picture of Mark Hamilton, you know, those guys put these guys together.
That was Bill Mooney.
Bill Mooney and all that. So I came up with a wonderful idea. On May 19, 92, I went over to Craig Flessel home with a friend of mine named Charlie Roberts, and I brought together not only Craig Flessel, was my first time meeting with him, but driving up, I located Vincent Sullivan to join us. And the third person who I went to go pick up at Babylon, New York, was Frank Arnier. On May 1992, I put all three of them together for the first time in many years.
And then we got Frank Arnier to this convention. We had him on the Golden Age panel.
Well, that was more Vince Sullivan.
I'm going to tell the Frank Arnier part. Frank was in a wheelchair, and he was on the Golden Age panel, and that year we had Joe Simon on the panel. We had Vince Sullivan, and we had Shelley Moldoff, I think, was on that year. Anyway, and we had an input. They had it to me to present, to make the kind of presentation that Gary just made. So I presented the Inkpot Award in a room about this size, I would guess, to Fred Gardiner. Now, Fred was in a wheelchair to my right. I was at the podium, on either side of me. And Fred started to get up to make the audience was on his feet like you were applauding. And Fred starts to get up. I whispered to him, "You don't have to stand up for this." And he said, "Yes, I do. It's the first award I ever got in my life." And he stood up. I was standing, you could see, I was standing behind him, holding the back of his pants. And he was very shaky on his feet at that point. And he made the most touching speech. I looked out at his family, his kids, and his grandkids were in the audience. They were crying. It was the first time, maybe the only time, that Fred Gardiner ever got any real recognition for what he had done. And that, to me, has been kind of the essence of comic fandom. That intersection of the people who made the comics and the people who love the comics. And, you know, a lot of these guys didn't get paid very well. In a lot of cases, we were their pension. They would bring them to the conventions and buying their art prints or buying commissions, original art. We financed the retirements of a lot of these people. There are comic book artists whose work we loved who would not have been able to afford their health care in their later senior years if not for comic book fandom, or who would have thought that their work was disposable and was as treated as badly as the editors in the 50s and 40s told them it was and how worthless it was. And we, us in this room, us who are, we, those of us who are comic fans, obviously we've all done a lot of the things for our own pleasure and enrichment and the fun of putting out fanzines and the fun of researching this stuff and writing articles. But that moment with Fred Gardiner, I always remember, and it's not the only one that if you came to the year, we had John Broome here. Same type of thing, almost the exact same type of story. The only time he ever in his life realized how much his work impacted people. Now, I would like to ask each person on the dais to tell us briefly where they were in their lives when the event occurred which you feel was your entree to comic book fandom. Where, what were you doing for a living? What did you want to do for a living? Where were you living? If you want to tell roughly how old you were, that's fine, it's not mandatory. And then when you started getting involved in it, what was the event where you went, okay, now I'm part of this little strange group here of strangers all over the country? Maggie?
It started when I was 4.5 years old, and I had a dime. And I went up to the newsstand on the corner, and I bought a comic book. And my mom, she didn't have to read it every night, but usually got bullied into every night reading that comic book for the next week, till I had another dime and bought another comic book. And on the seventh night, she found that she liked the story and the writing as much as she had liked it the first night. So she wrote my mom wrote a fan letter to the editorial offices at Dell, and it was a fan letter to Walt Keller. And he responded, and there began the collection, because it was the Kelly collection. And she put little notes in the front that it had to be kept separate from the other comic books. So 4.5, and and that was the start. Oh, and I met a little girl in kindergarten, and she also mentioned Kelly, and it turned out that this was in Ithaca, New York, which is where Cornell is. And it turned out that her dad also knew Walt Kelly. So this story grew up. Oh, there are other people out there. And the reason he knew Walt Kelly was he was head of the Modern Languages Department at Cornell. And during World War II, they had done booklets for, little pamphlets for service people in which there were phonetic translations for the servicemen. So if they were in France, they could ask for probably a drink of milk. And they needed cartoons.
The first thing a serviceman in France.
And they wanted to brighten it up, and they hired Walt Kelly to do the cartoons that went in it. So he actually had known Kelly at a business level. So yes, that was the, oh, there are other people there, and they correspond.
I have to interject to this room, because I know just people in this room. My lady friend Carolyn, who's the daughter of Walt Kelly, is not at this convention because he just yesterday, after a marathon of not sleeping for weeks, put to press the first volume of the complete Pogo, which is the graphics. Yeah. We have never seen more effort put into a loving restoration and presentation of someone's work. I wonder why she's so interested in that guy. Now, but Maggie, tell us about the first moment when you started corresponding with or intersecting with people, with strangers who were interested in comics.
Well, my mother was a science fiction writer you've never heard of. Her name was Betsy Curtis, and so we went to science fiction conventions when we could. Dad was a college professor, so he didn't have any money. But the concept of mimeographing a publication for your friends began again with her, and I put on my website, MaggieThompson.com, coincidentally, the front page of the first issue of that, and she was discussing what I was reading in comic books at that age. My first convention with a comic book connection was WorldCon in 1955 in Cleveland, and there was a dealer there named Howard DeVore, big part of Howard DeVore, and he had an Animal Comics I didn't have. And so I went up to him and I said, how much is that Animal Comics? And he said, it is literally priceless, this being 1955. There is no price. You could not find another one at that point, so it's either worth a fortune or it's worth nothing, and he handed it to
me. Okay. Dick and Pat, where were you professionally when you felt you were getting involved in comic book fandom? What were you doing? Where were you living? And by the way, to all the panelists, these microphones only really work when you talk in the right direction. And if anybody in the back can hear us, please wait. So get closer to the microphone and talk straightforward.
Well, I have always loved comics, and I have told a story about that yesterday, which I won't repeat, very vaguely being locked out in New York apartment, because I snuck out. I wasn't supposed to. I was 12 years old. I snuck out and went down to the stationery store and bought more comics. And my father had always read and done comics with me. I can't remember. It couldn't be since the day I was born, but maybe so. But I didn't realize comics as a break-off from books or anything else until we did our first fanzine, and we did the Big Red Cheese about Captain and Mary Marvel, and then we got all this response. I mean, we thought nobody was going to read this, nobody would be interested, and suddenly people were just writing back letters to us, and I was frankly very, very happy and totally amazed.
Dick?
Well, I want to tell you, when I was, I read comics from earliest childhood because I had an older brother who was into comics. So I was always leaning over his shoulder trying to figure out what do those little marks mean in the speech balloons until I learned how to read. But when I was maybe junior high school age, I had my first true inkling that there were creative people behind this. For a small child, they're just there. It's just a given. the sky is blue, all right, okay, and there are Chevrolet automobiles and there are comic books. They're just there. When I was around 12, I picked up a copy of Captain Marvel Adventures and turned to the little text story that nobody ever read. It was John Jarl, International Police, whatever, policeman, by a word that I read as Yendo Binder. And I thought, well, whoever Yendo Binder is really wrote this story. There's somebody, that means somebody must have written the other stories and somebody must have drawn the pictures and so forth. Years went by, and we did, Pat and I did the first issue of Zero, and Captain Marvel had always been my favorite, so I wrote this article, The Big Red Cheese, about Captain Marvel. At that point, Yendo Binder was the editor of a magazine called Space World, published in New York. We were living in New York. So I took a copy of the first issue of Zero up to the office there to give to him. And a very pleasant lady greeted me at the door. I later realized it was Ione Turek, Mrs. Yendo Binder. And I handed her a manila envelope with the fanzine in it. I said, this is for him. She said, oh, well, I'll get him out of the other room and you can hand you. I said, no. And I just shoved it in her hand and literally ran out of the office because I was terrified, you know, to actually be in the presence of this godlike figure, you know. If I could hand him the envelope, that would be all right. But if he insisted on shaking hands, I would immediately turn to a, you know, some sort of pile of ashes. Because the energy would be, and I would be gone. So I ran out. But very shortly, we received a letter from him saying, well, I really enjoyed your article, but there were a few little mistakes in it, of which he outlined, you know, 300 or 400 most obvious and serious ones. And we started corresponding back and forth, and they invited us to dinner at their home in New Jersey. And this was the first time that we had actually physically met these people. And the first thing I said, I shook hands and I wasn't even crisp, merely mildly tingled. And I said, oh, how do you do, Mr. Binder? And he said, actually, it's Binder. It's a German word. It means binder. But we had a lovely time with them, and we visited back and forth. At the time, Pat and I were members of a group in New York called the Fantasy Film Club. Remember, there were no VCRs then. There was no home videos. There was no such thing. Once the movie was gone, it was gone. But we had a friend named Chris Steinbrunner, who was the film library manager for a television station in New York. And he and a friend of his started this club. They had a movie projector in Chris's basement, and he would set up programs, and there would be club meetings. One week he would set up an Agatha Christie program. Another week he would set up a Boris Karloff show or whatever. We'd start early Sunday afternoon, watch two feature films, have a dinner break, watch the third feature film, and then everyone would go home. Alternately, we would sometimes run serials. If there was a 12-chapter serial, we'd run 8 chapters, dinner break, and then the last 4. And Chris got hold of a print of The Adventures of Captain Marvel. And we invited the Binders to come over as guests of honor for the showing that day. At that point, the club was meeting in our apartment in Manhattan. And we were a young couple and had had our first child, who was a little baby in diapers at that point. And being by this time an experienced Captain Marvel costume maker, everyone who was here yesterday knows that story, I made a costume for our little son. I got a pair of tiny red tights, cut out a yellow lightning bolt and stitched them on, and put them on him over his diaper. So when the Binders arrived, Otto, Ione, and their daughter Mary, I ran in the other room, brought out our little baby, and said, here he is, here's Captain Marvel, baby. And handed him to Otto. And he was just absolutely thrilled. He also told us that they'd never seen that movie. He'd never seen it. This was the first time he'd ever seen it. So we had a wonderful relationship with them. As for the general, the much broader fan community, it all came to us through Zero. As Pat mentioned, the response to that first article on the Big Red Cheese, which was more or less an experiment, you know, if nobody had cared, nobody had reacted to it, that would have been the end of it right there. Instead, the letters kept on coming. It was astonishing. And people kept volunteering, said, Dick Ellington, I want to write about Planet Comics. Jim Harmon, I want to write about the Justice Society of America. Bill Blackbeard said, I want to write about Popeye. It's his theory, the first superhero of them all. And this just kept on going month after month. Roy Thomas did a great one for us called, what was he called, Roy?
I believe someone gave you the title of Captain Billy's Whiz Gang.
Captain Billy's Whiz Gang. Right. Again, an in-group reference, because long before Whiz Comics existed, Billy Fawcett, who was an officer in the First World War, published a magazine called Captain Billy's Whiz Bang. And all these years later, he published Whiz Comics. So we had all these people, they were just falling over each other to get into the pages of the magazine. Maggie, you did a great piece for us on Little Lulu.
No.
You didn't?
No.
Who did?
I did an article on Little Lulu, but it that was later.
That was later. My mistake. It was a great article on Little Lulu.
I cut all the illustrations for Don's two articles.
Oh, for OK Axis, Here We Come.
Yes, I took the light box, and Bill Thaling alone does the issues, and I cut the mimeograph stencils. If anybody needs somebody to cut mimeograph stencils, here. Correction fluid, the whole thing.
And Don Thompson and I collaborated on an article about Zatara and Ibis the Invincible and all of the other supernatural Mandrake the Magician, called simply It's Magic. And we did it under a joint pseudonym because we didn't know that we were Dick O'Donnell.
Let me ask a question Roy would probably like to address this to. At that point, where did you research? What were the sources of information about these comics, aside from your own collections and looking at the books?
It was minimal. It was mainly just looking at old comic books. I remember heading down to Times Square to some used bookshops and getting hold of a manager there and saying, do you have any old comic books? And he would lead me to the back of the store and there would be, you know, like last month's adventure comics with the legion of teenage superheroes, whatever. And I would say, oh no, I mean really old ones. And he would scratch his hand and he'd find one maybe 2 months old. But fortunately, I stumbled across a store in New York called The Memory Shop, run by a man named Mark Ritchie, who sold what you might think of as cultural antiques rather than physical antiques. You didn't get beautiful old chiffoniers from him. You got Life magazine back issues or old newspapers. And he sold comic books going back to the very early 1940s. He had a standard price structure. Whatever comic book you were buying from him, title didn't matter, condition hardly mattered. It depended purely on the age, and his price was a dime a year. If you wanted a 20-year-old comic book, it would cost you $2. If you wanted a 25-year-old comic book, it would cost you $2.50. And that's the way he sold comics, and that's the way we did research.
Roy, where did you get research for early articles you wrote? Where did you learn about it? I mean, obviously you looked at the comics, but where did you find out who wrote and drew some of these things?
I was so unsophisticated at the age of 19, going on 20, that my first three letters, I think, to a comic book were written to three separate letters sent out at the same time with quasi-identical wording each time, every time, no such thing as photocopies, to the editor of Green Lantern, the editor of The Flash, and the editor of the editor of Justice League of America. Of course, they all wound up on Julius Schwartz's desk, and I got this note from him because I was asking about, did they have any old All-Star comics or something like that lying around the office they wouldn't mind getting rid of? I might have been able to scrape up a dime a copy for them or something. But I asked, if I could find out who who wrote Justice League, so he told me, you know, Gardner Fox. And by the way, Gardner Fox also wrote the first bunch of several dozen Justice Society, which is the first time I'd ever had any inkling, you know, that he wrote that, or Hawkman. And that led me, Gardner Fox sent me Jerry Bale's address, and I sold these the things, the bound books, to a young guy from Kansas City and so forth, and now he's in Detroit, Michigan, and he's and everything, and he bought them, and he might enjoy hearing from you, because he likes the Justice Society, so I sent this letter off right before my 20th birthday, and Jerry responded by sending me a nice letter, and three issues of All-Star Comics. He happened to have lying around his triplicates, really. Two of them incomplete, but that's great. But as far as research, when we started Alter Ego, soon in the just two or three months after Jerry and I met through the mail, the research I had a bunch of old comics left over. A lot of them were coverless, at least from the last half of the 40s. And one or two that I found, like a Cub Scout doing, I found a coverless All-Star from 1944, and I had a Superman from 1942 that I found at my grandparents' place. I hung on to for years because it had an All-Star cover ad in it with Dr. Fate and all these characters I'd never heard of before. I did the Bestest League as a parody of Justice League and a new Spectre character, so I didn't really do any until the second issue, when I wrote an article about the only one of the two All-Winter Squad stories that we could find, Marvel's, you know, group with Captain America, Torch, and Submariner. But it had two or three pages missing, so I had to say, well, I don't know how Submariner, you know, whipped that tidal wave in that story. I had to wait about several years before I got a copy of that. And when I wrote the article a year or so later, for Zero, my research was the same thing that Richard Kyle had. Dick sent me a bunch of Fawcett comics, and I used those plus my memories, and maybe I had a few of them by then, not too many. And of course, I've been reading Fawcett comics since the mid-40s, and so it was all memory. At the time, we were still doing it mostly on kind of nostalgia, but, you know, sort of edging toward history. Even though Dick, you know, he always talked about this is the start of nostalgia. Jerry used to say I was on the start of nostalgia boom, but, you know, it was always more than that. We were interested in the history of the field, whether, like me, you were really interested in history as an academic pursuit or just because you like history. I think everybody from All in Color for Dime number one on just about was interested in the actual history of the medium. Who wrote them? Who drew them? And then if you go further and further back, one person that Dick had in the second issue of Zero, which was another guy really interested in the history, probably more than most, was Ted White, who did a wonderful early job chronicling the whole history of DC Comics, which probably had never been done before.
You remember the title of his essay?
The Spawn of
Spawn NC of Games. NC Games. Yeah.
I want to add one thing, though. We were giving credit to various good people, and Roy keeps talking about Julia Schwartz, and one cannot say too much about Julia Schwartz. He was the most delightful person. Once he began to tune into what we were doing, what Alter Ego was doing, what comic art was doing, and what Zero was doing. Now, Julie was an old-time science fiction fan from the 1930s himself, and he invited me up to the D.C. offices. I forget whether I called him or he called me first, but in any case, he said, well, come on up. So I went up there one day. I was a junior executive of a large corporation at the time, so I show up wearing my suit and white shirt and carefully made tie. And Julie shakes my hand and he said, well, come on around and I'll introduce you to some of the gang. He said, this is Joe Kubert and this is Murphy Anderson. Here's my old pal, Mort Weisinger. And yeah, you ought to get to know these people. Everybody was very, very hospitable and friendly. I wish that I had followed up on that to a greater extent than I did. But I was up there a few times and Julie in particular, all of them were very, very hospitable and helpful. But Julius Schwartz above all. I mean, he's the man as far as I'm concerned.
Let's ask Richard Kyle. Richard, what were you doing professionally or personally? Where were you when you first got involved in, obviously you were reading comics before that, but at what point did you start corresponding or connecting with other readers, other people who were interested?
Bill Spicer saw my address in... Bill Spicer, who was an absolutely brilliant publisher and editor in the comics field, the amateur comics field, Bill saw my address in Zero, I believe it was. It may have been Alter Ego, I'm not sure. And wrote me, and he was at that point putting together Fantasy Illustrated, which was not a fan magazine in the ordinary sense. It was all newly written. Some of the stuff was adapted from professionals. Pardon me. It wasn't literally an amateur comic book, and with surprisingly good artists in it. And from there, at that time I was writing fiction, and in a small way, and I knew nothing about the mechanics of printing, of offset printing, or anything of that kind. And Bill was working for an art studio or something similar, somewhere in advertising, and he knew about all of this stuff. And so the fact that I could then turn what I could mentally, I could envision the stories and the layout and the design and everything, why I didn't have, hadn't had previously any sense of how you put it together and took it down to a printer and bargained him down on his rate, you know, and all of that sort of thing. And so from then on, why I really was associated very closely with Bill's magazine. But I would say Zero itself and meeting Bill were the things that impelled me to become a fan magazine writer and publisher eventually. But I would like to make one note. My first experience with comic books was in 1934, and it was in a mom-and-pop bookstore here in San Diego. I live in Northern California, and at the time. And I came into the store with my stepfather, and by the cash register, there were, I think, two piles of this strange-looking magazine. And it was, they were comic books. There was something instantaneously transforming for the experience because they were new. I somehow or another knew they were new. They hadn't existed before. And apparently I either saw one of the issues of Funnies on Parade, which was a promotional title, or it was the first issue of Famous Funnies. But I didn't ask my stepfather to buy it because it was a depression, and you could get two loaves of bread for a dime, and you could get a quart of milk for a dime. And since I couldn't read, I thought that was being a little chancy. But anyway, the other thing about it is too that the kids in school. We knew who the writers were, who were the ones, the writers and artists were. The ones that were printed in the magazines, we didn't know bylines, but we knew Bill Everett and Carl Burgos and Bob Davis. And I can remember talking when I was 8 and 9 years old with these other kids who were equally familiar with them. And I was just in love with Centaur Comics. And Bill Everett was the managing editor there, and all of the people. It was just a wonderfully crack-brained series of magazines that they came out with. But they first came out with Pioneer Picture Stories and Detective Picture Stories. Even then, somebody was trying to change the name of comics to something else. And we talk about it. We knew about them. Guys kept in the neighborhood kept really large collections, generally up in their attic or someplace like that. But initially, comic books weren't frowned on by adults. That was created somewhere along the line, and maybe what people have to say here today will give some sense of when comic books' image went completely wrong, and it was well before the Wortham, Dr. Frederick Wortham, it was well before he attacked comics. But in any event, I was a fan from the time before I could read, and when I met Bill, and I had read Alter Ego and Zero, that was the beginning of my real involvement in fandom, and beginning to express myself in a non-professional way, because I always separate, and I always have separated, my professional from my non-professional work.
Mr. Shelley, same question for you. Where did you get into this whole mess?
Well, I wasn't exactly employed. I was 12 years old. I think I probably represent on this panel the people who were the baby boomers, who were the whole group of people that were kind of the rank and file of part of fandom, the younger set, and many of us here today were part of that group. And the baby boomers were the ones who, I think, kind of fueled the Silver Age in terms of sales. And for me, I was 12 years old, so I had just started junior high, and life had suddenly gotten complicated, you know. Changes were happening around me and to me, and getting along with people in junior high got to be kind of problematic, and I really didn't have very, very many friends. So when I discovered comics fandom, it was like suddenly there was a way that I could be part of something and have a network of people that I knew, people that wouldn't make fun of me for reading comics, who loved them, and no one was going to tell me that I couldn't be part of it. I mean, at one point my mom looked at a fanzine I got and said, is this dirty? I said, well, you can look through it. I said, what do you mean? She said, well, you know, I'm a little worried you're getting these things from strange men in other cities. And but they basically, the only hurdle I had to pass was that I kept my grades up. As long as I did that, I could publish my fantasy. And I had nothing to say. I knew nothing about old comics. But I was going to publish something because I wanted to, and I was determined to, and I could. And this gave me the beginning of learning how to become a writer, learning how to publish, learning how to draw and present things to other people and correspond. I mean, basically, I was a little entrepreneur at 13 years old. And I learned about business. I had my own, in a sense, I had like a little small business. And I learned a lot of things about that that became in handy in later years in that sense. But as far as those days of fandom and the information that was available, I think one of the key things were the Rockets Glass specials that Gordon Love published. You know, he did RBCC, Rockets Glass, but he did these Rockets Glass specials that were long articles, usually by Raymond Miller, about All-American comics, Timely comics, and I think he must have sold over the years probably 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 copies of that Timely one, and he reprinted it over and over, and it was like these were like basic information sources that we could learn kind of the basic framework and piece the structure a little bit of comics of the past. The information was very sketchy and rudimentary, but it was a beginning. And that was a little different than, you know, it wasn't really nostalgic. It had to do with some of the details. But, you know, fandom was still actually forming when I got involved in it. I wouldn't call myself a founder of fandom. I'm here because I write about founders of fandom. I was just a kid who was thrilled to discover fandom, and it changed my life.
Gene, tell us your experience.
Do you want me to tell you Jerry's story or my story?
Why don't you start with Jerry's story, and then we'll go to your story.
Okay, well, I think Jerry got very interested in All-Stars when he was about 7 or 8. Anyway, when he could read.
What year was Jerry born in?
He was born in 1933. And he wanted to get a hold of them, and so he used to dress up his brother a few years later to go down to the comic store where they had Mayors, and he'd say, "You want to donate to the poor?" He'd dress up his brother and the clothes they had to wear, holds them. I don't think his mother would have approved of that. She did, but and so he got the comics that way. And during the war drive, it was patriotic to turn in your comics. You weren't supposed to keep any kind of papers. But he'd go around with his little wagon and his brother Gins. Say, "Would you like to donate something to the war drive?" Yeah. And so he really loved All Star. He loved the stories. He thought the stories had a moral to them, and they were well written. And his father didn't think he should be collecting comics. He said, "I gotta get those things up." But he persisted. And that's probably how he got those triplicate copies that you're talking about. They're probably beaten up pretty much. But so anyway, that was the story. And ever since that time, we've been trying to bring back All Star.
All right. Now, where did you get involved in comics?
Oh, golly. Well, like some of the other panelists, I've got Walt Disney's Comics and Stories in subscription folded up. And before I could even read, I was making up the stories to go along with the pictures. I was also writing music at the time, but it turned out I'm not too good at either one. So Walt Disney Comics and Stories, and then later on, of course, Archie and Matt and Benny and Veronica series. Every time I went to the dime store or Kresge's, Woolworths, I'd pick up some of those. And then I got into my brother's Mad magazines when they were still in the smaller format before it became large. And let's see, I didn't get into superheroes too much. I did read Superman, and I remember hitting my brother once when he said, "You know, there's also Superboy and Supergirl." I thought, "You don't mess with the legend. You know, he's lying." So I thought, "I'm like, no!" Then I got into it, of course, big time, Jerry. We used to read the comics together. Everything that came out, and let's see, 66, 67, 68, 69. And I really got into it. It was interesting because sometimes he would read it, you know, with inflection like, that's about it.
All right. Let me ask everyone here briefly, to what extent did you find, and Bill touched a little bit upon this, that being involved with comic fandom supplemented your regular life? It was like fun to have these other friends in other cities and be part of this little secret society. And to what extent was comic book fandom a way for you to have a different kind of friend than you were getting at work or at school or at home or your neighborhood? Does that make any sense, that question I'm asking?
In my particular case, because I grew up basically in science fiction fandom, there was an anecdote. So several years ago, major, major, wonderful writer, science fiction fan named Walt Willis. And he spoke of overhearing his daughter, I believe it was, being visited by some fellow children. And the other kid said, what are all those on the table? And her response was, well, those are fanzines, silly. And that was the world in which I grew up. So it was, yes, it was an alternate universe, but I grew up surrounded by it my entire life. And I always thought it was more important than the people I knew in school because they were grown-ups. So I was reading grown-ups writing about things I cared about, which included comics once in a while. When I was reading, it was mostly about science fiction. But yeah, these were the interesting people. And that was the way it always was. But as I say, it was science fiction for me.
When I got involved, it's a little later than some of you in all this, I found that science fiction fandom was enormously hostile to comic book fandom. There was this, particularly in Los Angeles, there was this, and then later all the science fiction fans were coming to the comic conventions playing dressed up as Star Trek people. But there was this notion that was the little kids' version, and we didn't want it around science. We didn't want science fiction fandom to be tainted with comic books. Did anybody encounter that sentiment?
It just depended on who you talk to. There are the fake snobs who don't know what the hell they're talking about. I don't care what generation it is. Not only were Dick and Pat Lukoff as Captain and Mary Marvel a sensation at the Pittsburgh World Science Fiction Convention in 1960, but I believe it was the next year when the entire Los Angeles Science Fiction Society came to Worldcon dressed as the Justice Society. Bijo Trimble talked John Trimble into coming as Sandman because it was the most outrageous costume in the world. You know, it was like, what, the green jacket and the orange whatever and the brown hat and whatever and the gas mask, so that was cool. But the classic was Jack Harness, who they talked into being Hawkman. And I have a photo of the group. And Frank Pack was the Flash, but here's Jack Harness. So they had the Hawkman costume, but they hadn't really worked out about the wings. So he had the wings, but they weren't suspended by the straps. And the idea was, he'd hold the wings like this. Now, you have to understand that the costume competition lasted for, an hour? 2 hours? And so slowly, descended. And the only person that Don overheard respond to that costume was, look, it's Henry Haw!
Roy, were you nodding when I started asking about science fiction fandom? Did I see you nod in recognition of...
Well, I was always... I was more thinking in terms of the fact that... I think this is true for over half the people on this panel, that when we grew up, we didn't have fandom as a support base. We'd been happy if we'd been like Mag and been part of science fiction fandom. I would have been, too, from 13 to 14 years old. Been happy to. The trouble is that there wasn't anything for us. We couldn't have that secret pen pal life that Bill talked about because, I knew when I was a kid, a number of people, friends of mine read comics. I saw one friend of mine trying to sneak out of my birthday party with a Wonder Woman comic that somebody else had given me. That's the kind of friends I had. Department Page was issued also a friend, but I didn't think anybody, since there were no comics in the late 50s coming out much, I bought Superman, Batman, Archie, and Disney stuff and here and there. Never liked horror or crime comics, and Mad, of course, Pogo. But I never didn't think people, really saw me. They didn't see me much with comics because, and yet whenever I go back, I say, how do you always remember you with comic books? I must have had them sometime earlier, but I never took them to school or haven't, lying around a lot. That came more like when I ruined my college years. But, but I was always aware earlier from the very beginning, you could sort of see that, you know, not Richard and Pat, but, you know, even Ted White, Robert was, you know, kind of looking a little down at the comics. And, you know, Alter Ego number one, he wrote a letter saying it was too gosh wild for him, you know, a little bit. And he was really right, in a way. We were trying for a whole different kind of thing than Richard and then Don and Maggie and Pat were doing. So, but there was always that kind of snobbishness, but even though I was never really a member of science fiction fandom, I was always fascinated with it because I liked, you know, science fiction, and I always saw the two as being together. And what of course Jerry and the other people of us did in early comics fandom was swipe everything that wasn't nailed down in science fiction fandom. The term fanzine. So many of my, yeah, the convention thing, the which, you know, Jerry was hollering for the game, then the idea of awards that I came up with, you know, well, I was aware by that time of the Hugos, you know, things of this sort, as well as the Academy Awards. And we just sort of looted whatever was in Zero and the other few fans, science fiction fandoms I got, none of which ever really particularly interested me, you know, nearly as much as Zero, even without the comic book features. You know, we just took whatever we could, and the term fancy, you know, then eventually entered the language slowly over the years, and, you know, we just kept bringing things in and a lot of attitudes and so forth. I was probably bigger on bringing those attitudes into fandom, and so, I'm sure Maggie was, than say Jerry was, because Jerry was never really interested in science fiction fandom like the other people in this panel all were. All the rest of us were at least science fiction fans of a sort.
I should apologize for butting in here, but I will just mention that when at the World Science Fiction Convention in 1960, we had a discussion with the dealer, Bill Vailing, and then our friend Hal Lynch, as to wouldn't it be great to do a magazine about comics, a fanzine about comics. And somewhere in my house is the letter that Hal wrote following up to say, now we have to differentiate science fiction. We can't just be using the same terms, because if we're going to do an amateur, if we're going to do a fanzine about it, we call it a fanzine, the science fiction fans won't realize it's about comics. And so we were looking, the letter from Hal, he was looking for terms, and he suggested, and then immediately rejected the term condom.
Put in just for a moment before we leave the costume aspect of this, which sort of branched off into. Nobody has said anything about a pair that I saw at an early science fiction convention that just blew me away. None of the costumes were so elaborate, they were very modest, but they were so perfectly authentic and on target. And it was Ibis the Invincible and Princess Taya, and maybe Maggie, you could talk a little bit about that.
I would just mention that, of course, with Ibis and Taya, the elaborate costuming involved a suit, a turban, a red dress for me, a yellow belt, and a yellow thingy. So it was. We were looking for the effect, and man, that was cheap, and that was those days. Yeah. Now you look at the costumes in the hall and faint.
Another thing that came from science fiction fandom that was the Amateur Press Alliance. In fact, the person that named Kappa Alpha is here at the convention this year, Johnny Chambers. He was a member of FAPA, and that was a science fiction, venerable, long-running science fiction Amateur Press Alliance. And he said, well, for comics, it should be Kappa. So Kappa Alpha it was. So that was just one more way that science fiction fandom, that we, you know, took something from the earlier fandom and just adapted it to who we were. And of course, by the way, I think both FAPA and Kappa Alpha are still around. I know Kappa Alpha is.
How many
still
people,
going.
Yeah. How many people in this room were ever members of Kappa Alpha?
We were the second central mailers.
Does anyone here not know where Napa is? All right, fine. I won't be coming back. Let me ask this person on the panel, if you just stood on the panel briefly. You can answer two questions for me. I don't need stories here. If you want to tell them, that's fine. But I want to know the first convention you ever attended, and if it was a science fiction convention, you can also carve out the first comic convention I ever attended, and tell me the first fanzine that you ever published something in, the name of it, and the year. All right? So we're starting with Gene. What was the first convention you ever went to?
Yes, it would have been about 1967, and I was really wow. I mean, it was like
probably. Where was it?
It was in Detroit. It was at Shelby Sheridan, his double name of some sort. And I remember Jerry was really, really excited because he said, "There's someone here from England for international."
And what was the first fanzine you ever contributed to?
I didn't contribute to any in a direct way. No.
All right. Roy, what was the first fanzine you ever had work in?
That would be hard. It was Alter Ego number one. It came out at the end of March 1961. The magazine was originally going to be called just the JLA newsletter, and so forth, and expanded by that time to Alter Ego with a hyphen, number one. First convention was 1965, about 3-4 weeks after I had moved to New York to join the field. Dave Cayley, with whom I was temporarily living there in the Lower East Side, was throwing what was really the second real convention. There had been that small one in 1964. Throwing this convention, it was the first, what Bill called the first full-service convention, because it was really more like a convention. I mean, you had the first panel. I'm really proud of this. The first panel ever at a comic convention, really, was a writer's panel. You know, we had, the guests would be Bill Finger, except he was late, and Jordan Fox, Otto Binders, the editor, and Mort Weisinger, who came in, you know, while he was there as an editor, he, of course, had also been a writer, and Jerry Bales moderated, and they were all there. And then
you had a panel I didn't moderate? You had a panel I didn't moderate?
Yeah, we out there. So that was the first one. Then later, we had a second panel, just sort of everybody. I was there on the panel to represent the fan point of view, and I was sitting next to Jim Warren, with whom we formed a sort of instantaneous animosity. And Bill Kane, Senator, and he was so agitated, sitting, getting up and down in the front row, that he was finally invited to join the panel. So I met him that day. So it was a very nice convention. About a year before, the Broadway Central Hotel, in which it was hell basically collapsed. So, even then, people had to sort of walk up the side of the stairs, but I guess I understand it sagged in the middle of it. It was pretty bad, and it was really pretty wonderful. And I went as to the costume party as Plastic Man in costume. My aunt had made for me wearing dark sunglasses and so forth, and trying to stretch as far as I could.
You know, we're going to take a moment pause here so that Mike. Catch Ron on the mic on the camera and switch cartridges. Yes, makes sense. Whatever he says,
okay. Quick, tell the good one before he gets rolling again. No.
Thank you. Okay, Bill, first convention, first contribution to a fanzine.
Yeah. The first contribution to a fanzine, no one would publish my stuff, so I became the publisher of my stuff. And that was the imaginatively titled magazine, Superheroes Anonymous. I don't know why I thought of that.
That's great.
But it was the title, and I wrote for that. But the first convention, I only went to one major convention, which was in 1973 in New York. But Pittsburgh, where I grew up, had a what we called the Mini PitCon in 1967, and we had about 8 people there. One of them was Jim Shooter, who lived in Pittsburgh. One of them was Bill Wilson, who published The Collector. Bill was 13 at that time. There was a banquet that was a weenie roast. And we just had a ball, but it was really the first fan gathering in Pittsburgh. And then Bill was telling me the other night, it's interesting, that Pittsburgh has another claim to fame, which is the appearance of Dick and Pat Lupoff as Captain and Mary Marvel was in Pittsburgh. So we have another thing we can say locally there. But that was my first convention experience, sort of. But then New York in 1973 was when I tried to get into the New Talent program at DC, and that was a farce. But the one of the funny things about that convention to me, or what interesting things, was Bob Kane gave the speech, and he was the big guest of honor at that convention. And he got up, and of course, here's Bob Kane, the creator of Batman. And so a huge applause. It was like this massive applause, and he got up. 45 minutes later, he left the stage, and half the hall had left, and there was a smattering of applause and coughing. He spent the whole time saying how great and brilliant he was. And it was really embarrassing, and it really, for the first time, you realized, for me anyway, that some of my heroes had feet of clay.
I was at that talk. Bill was describing it accurately. It was, and for the rest of the convention, people went around using the following phrase: "Hey, did you hear Bob the Putz Kane?" I thought it was about the time he was telling us about having sex with Marilyn Monroe.
My experience with Bob Kane live was on radio. This was pretty early on. I was 12, maybe 13 years old. And there was a show called King Kaiser's College of Musical Knowledge that had run as a half-hour show, but it had been converted to a strip show. That is, that it ran Monday through Friday. So I was sitting, it was just before I left to go to school, always. And I listened to it. And one day, they were interviewing the new contestants and asked this fellow what his name was. He says, "My name is Bob King." And it was certain that in his mind there was nobody more important than Bob Kane. Well, he was just kind of a jerk a little bit, and they asked him a question that was the equivalent of, you know who's buried in Grant's tomb? I mean, it was that elemental. And he blundered around and everything and couldn't answer the question. And and was taken off of the panel. But it was a sense of anticipation. Bob Kane, well, God, this guy's got to be something and be somebody important. And here was just a schmuck. You know?
If we keep doing Bob Kane stories, we'll never get to that. Because I got about an hour of them. Yeah. Richard, what was the first convention you ever went to? What was the first fanzine? Was it Zero was the first thing you ever contributed to?
Which Richard?
Kyle.
Yes, it was Zero. It was the first one. I was always a fan of science fiction, but I was never much of a science fiction fan. So I knew all about what was going on in science fiction, and I used to read a lot of the magazines. Some of them were extremely literate, which kind of left me out because I left school at 13. And the desire to write about science fiction was such that I actually learned how to write from that experience, and I continued to have it for many years after the science fiction magazines no longer warranted any comment by anybody. But anyway, yes, it was Zero. The very first issue of Zero that Dick and Pat sent me, and it really made a remarkable difference. And Alter Ego is a little bit later, and I think for my interest. And there's some reality to science fiction fans looking down on comics fans, because if you think about it, most of the comics fans at the time were 13, 14 years old, and most of the science fiction fans were really grown adults. They were 18, 19. But also the science fiction fanzines dealt frequently, not very often, but with some frequency. Dealt with serious writing and different and critical ideas and things like that. And the number of professional writers and publishers that came out of science fiction, the early days of science fiction fandom, is really remarkable. I mean, I could spend the next 5 minutes enumerating people that went on to become writers and publishers, but Fred Pohl as a writer, as an editor, Don Walheim, who created his own paperback publishing company, and a lot of people whose names are not important to somebody who's not necessarily in the publishing business, but just an incredible number, and artists came along and everything. So it was really a complete world, and it had very irritating people in it, and it had really terrific people in it. But it was separate, but kind of adjoining to Comics fandom. I think somebody, was it Maggie that mentioned that, Jimmy Taurasi, that was the Science Fiction Times, he had special issues of things outside of that, outside of the science fiction line. And one of them was Fantasy News and Science Fiction News. And there were other magazines that came along, even an Amazing Mystery Funnies comic book. There was either a one or two pages were devoted to promoting books, magazines by our readers, or something like that. I can't remember the title of it. But they ran that, so it wasn't as though there was a complete isolation here. It was just this extraordinary bloom of interest. That's what the difference was.
One of the topics I wanted to get to, if we have time here, was the vast number of people who, because of comic book fandom, became comic book writers, artists, editors, publishers, and such like that. Roy, Roy?
How about you? How about you? How about you?
True or false, you never would have gotten into comics if not for fandom.
I doubt it. I was so unambitious and so unadventurous. I would never have moved to New York with the idea of doing it, and I would never have thought anybody could do it. Although I did get, write my first story when I was still living in St. Louis area because I was doing Alter Ego. But again, it was because of Alter Ego, where the Charlton editor, Pat Masuda, right before Dick Giordano took over, wanted somebody to write stories for something like Son of Vulcan or Blue Beetle, those late stories. And we were supposed to put things in our magazine to tell people to do it. I never put that in my magazine. Of course, I didn't publish it once every 6 months or so. I just wrote the story myself to help with everybody else. And so I sold my first couple of stories, $4 a page, and that was the start. So maybe I would have ended up doing it, a little bit of work for Charlton from there. But basically, yeah, it was really the fanzines. And that was true with so many different people, writers and artists in those years. So many people came out of it. Marv Wolfman, these guys were all, almost all interested in fandom first.
Did you see, this may be a tough question here, you had a lot of people submitting stuff to you, artwork and excuse, and we all saw the fanzines. Some of those people went on to be solid professionals at full careers, but this is, some of them did a couple of little things and went away. Are you surprised which ones were serious in the business and which one? Were there people who were contributing stuff to Alter Ego or sending stuff in or fans at the time who thought, gee, why didn't that guy become a real great comic artist? Why didn't that guy become...
To some extent, Bill Joe White, who had kind of a nice Batman, Dick Tracy kind of style, but who didn't really want to push that kind of thing. And the other guy who we thought was good, and maybe if he pushed just the right way, I think could have done it. Two friends, Ron Foss and Grass Green. Grass Green did eventually do some stories for Charlton, and I almost got into doing a thing for Marvel. And Ron Foss, I did get to draw one little feature, not Brad Dackley, which meant a lot to him. And I think I used a Bill Joe White page in The Invaders once as a fake character. I had Bill Joe do that page, so forth, and named the character after him, but I had captured by the Nazis, and I never remembered to release it. But those were the main people, because they were all really good artists. The other people, but there was never anybody that got into comics from fanzines that I was surprised, where I thought, boy, this guy didn't have the talent, and I was surprised they got in. If they got in, I think they deserved it. There were a few other people that maybe just didn't have as Bill has written, and he would, like Ron Foss, when we got to know who it was, just didn't have quite the right drive, and maybe luck. you know, to it, and you know, and so forth. I mean, there's a lot of luck involved. If I hadn't, you know, done a couple of things accidentally right, including drop a line to Jerry Bales, and, you know, a couple of things here and there, you know, any number of things, and I could end up, I could have, you know, I could have been a hostage, you know, or something during the Iranian crisis because of my, when I would have gone into foreign relations or something. You know.
I was kind of fascinated to watch it. I was at that in the fanzines a lot at a time when people were making that segue over and starting, and a lot of them turned up when Warren lost Archie Goodwin and he was paying $8 a page or comics, and some of these fanzine guys were having an opening. And it was interesting that there were certain people to me who went the distance, and some people just did a couple of stories and they couldn't handle professional commitments, or they, whatever it was, they didn't have the talent, they didn't have, like Roy says, the drive, and they dropped out. And I think if you look back, Richard mentioned, Kyle mentioned, that Bill Spicer, when he started out, was a really, knew more about printing, and Bill had a pretty good career in publishing. I don't think, know that Bill was an editor of Western Publishing for a while. He was also a house letterer for a long time. He lettered a lot of the comics I wrote for them. And he's a real, really knowledgeable guy, and he hardly had a professional career. Of course, Roy had a lot of people who are now, you know, last night, Roy was a recipient of the Hall of Fame Award at Marv Wolfman. These are guys who started in fanzines are now in the Hall of Fame in comics.
Shows you what they didn't fall into.
I didn't hear that, sorry.
That shows you what things have fallen to.
Well, you know, And also, last night they inducted Mort Drucker. Shouldn't Mort Drucker have been the first guy in the Hall of Fame? But I find it fascinating that, you know, Roy is 70 years old. I'm going to be 60 next year. I don't believe either of us are those ages. I still think of Roy. I met Roy in 1969. I still think of him as that same guy. I still think I'm the same guy who went up to the Marvel offices in 1970, actually, 1970. And I feel like nobody else is changing, and all of a sudden we're becoming the elder statesmen of this business, which is scary. I had somebody come up to me last night and they shook my hand and said, I just want to shake a hand that shook Jack Kirby's hand. Yes. It's been that long that Jack's been gone? Oh, okay. So it's very strange. We only have a couple more minutes here. Dave, you want to have a question?
I'm kind of curious about one thing. Back in 1966, they were writing about the Batman TV show. Since there was no fanzine for comics back in the 1950s, I am curious, what was science fiction people talking about The Adventures of Superman with George Reeves? What was your reaction to that TV show?
Do I remember fanzines, science fiction fanzines covering the George Reeves Superman show?
I don't remember them writing anything about it, but it wasn't regarded as being particularly exceptional either. I mean, there was a border where you really weren't talking about comics. It's like today. They talk about sci-fi movies. Well, those aren't science fiction movies.
Well, but to some extent, there was the knowledge that Jerry and Joe had started in science fiction fame.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm sure that there were comments in assortments of fanzines that are now gone, in which they referred to it in one way or another.
Yeah. In fact, Jerry and Joe published, were fanzine publishers.
Yes, exactly. The writing of the Superman was their fanzine story.
But also, I should mention that there was coverage in some of the science fiction fanzines as early as the late 1930s and 40s about specifically committed science fiction comic strips. I remember there was one long essay in a fantasy comparing Brick Bradford, Buck Rogers, and Flash Gordon, and the virtues and shortcomings of each of these three strips. They were in the context, though, of this is science fiction in a slightly different form. It was not in the context that comics are themselves a topic of interest.
There was also, just as a footnote on Superman in the 50s, there was probably the first fanzine ever published devoted to a comic book character was called The Story of Superman in 1952, published by Ted White and I think Ronnie Graham and maybe one other person. And, you know, admittedly, you know, it had a circulation of 35 copies. But the point being that there were people doing some comics and giving attention to Superman. Probably that happened in 1952 When did the TV show start?
I'm just saying that it's like saying, gee, is there any conversation on the internet today about Yo Gabba Gabba? Somewhere, you bet there was commentary. Do we have it referenced? Most of the science fiction material, the knowledge is in the brains of old creepy people like me. A question arose that I actually researched and posted on my website last week, which was somebody said, well, you know, the origins of the saying it is a proud and lonely thing to be a fan is lost. No one will know where that comes from. And I wrote it, and I explained it, and so forth. And one was an astounding science fiction story in which the last line was, it is a proud and lonely thing to be a man. And then Robert Bloch, in a hilarious Romana Clay science fiction funny short story in Fantastic Universe, did a story about how many centuries from now, of course, fandom will be the origins of everything that's important in the world. And the last line of that story was, it is a proud and lonely thing to be a fan. Why is it lost to the internet? Because nobody sat down and did that research and made that connection. And it wasn't in Fancyclopedia 2, which isn't that searchable anyway. So that's why it's up to us to preserve all the stuff in panels like this. Just saying.
You know, there's all...
Unfortunately, we are out of time here. You got to get a last line, Richard?
Well, the last line was that science fiction and comics were very closely related because that first issue of the Mimeograph fanzine that Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster published also carried editorial comments by him about how they were working on a new illustrated feature. And by that, they meant a comic strip.
Yeah. And I saw the art, some of the art for that did survive.
And so there's always been a connection between the two. But age divided people to a great extent, I think.
By the way, they worked out the marketing plan for Superman cereal and so forth. They, even when they were still working it up as proposals, it was the full-fledged marketed concept.
Amazing. Well, we are going to be out of time, and I've got to go to the printer wall. But I would like you to join me in thanking Maggie Thompson.